Educating the world about Bitcoin has succeeded in building a community of knowledgeable, dedicated, enthusiastic people from the fields of tech, economics, politics, and finance. But orange pilling has taken us as far as it can. Like many strategies, the marginal gains of educating the world were remarkable in the early stages, but they've flattened. Orange pilling has stopped working. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. This show is brought to you by Swan Bitcoin, the place to buy Bitcoin and get on a Bitcoin standard if you want to start buying Bitcoin, or you are ready to be, you are live on Bitcoin and know everything there is to know about it. Swan is the start and the finish. And then you want to get it on your cold storage? You want to get it on a cold card hardware wallet to know that you own it and that it is safe so you can sleep like a baby? Check them out. And there's a discount code, special links, you name it. Lots of goodies right in the show notes. Check them out. All right, we have got a great little read today. I'm actually out in the mountains. I'm literally sitting on the deck on the balcony right now recording this. And it is really nice out here. I wish I should record out here like this more often. But we got a short read today, which turned into a lot longer guy's take than I had just anticipated. But I think he has a really good, Roy Scheinfeld, who I love. What they are building over there is fantastic. And he also just always has really great perspectives on what's going on in space and where we need to target or like what to attack next in the markets. And I think this is a great one. This one is titled Orange Pilling Has Stopped Working. And, you know what? I won't give too much of it away. We will just get right into the article because I think you're going to enjoy this one. All right. So let's dive right in to today's article. And it's titled, Orange Pilling Has Stopped Working, by Roy Scheinfeld. In the context of Bitcoin, quote, normie means something like, don't know, don't care. And normie comes from normal. In other words, normal people don't care about Bitcoin, at least not enough to use it. Lack of exposure is not the problem. Bitcoin now regularly appears in the headlines of mainstream media, like USA Today, Fox, Forbes, The Economist, Le Monde, you name it. The term Bitcoin generates more search traffic than other terms most of us are sick of hearing, like Kardashian. But even though virtually every human and most seagulls have heard of Bitcoin, fewer than 500,000 use it daily. And it's not for lack of effort on the part of the Bitcoin community. We've written books, blogs, so many blogs, recorded videos, organized conferences and meetups, and hosted podcasts, so many podcasts, preaching the value of Bitcoin. We put more effort into converting the no-coin infidels than most religions, but our beautiful temple remains sadly empty. Educating the world about Bitcoin has succeeded in building a community of knowledgeable, dedicated, enthusiastic people from the fields of tech, economics, politics, and finance, but orange pilling has taken us as far as it can. Like many strategies, the marginal gains of educating the world were remarkable in the early stages, but they flattened. Orange pilling has stopped working. Show, don't tell. I realize how controversial this claim is because orange pilling is so popular. It's a strategy that has served us really well over the past 15 years, and most Bitcoiners like education. We tend to be critical thinkers who devour blogs and books and podcasts to learn more about our passion and keep our minds sharp. But we don't research every topic, nor do we have to. I know very little about what a good workout and eating healthy do to my body on a cellular level, but I feel the benefits of both. In fact, our world is so complex that nobody can really understand all the important facets. How many welders and virologists or aeronautical engineers and app developers really understand each other's fields? Most people are ignorant about most useful topics, and that's just the way it is in a highly complex world. Expertise, however, is not a precondition of enjoyment. I use all kinds of products and technologies, TikTok, AI assistants, and even water treatment plants, simply because they make my life better. That's all I really need to know. No technical understanding required. All you need to benefit from a technology is utility. It just has to improve people's lives somehow, whether they understand it at a granular level or not. We can tell people about Bitcoin's benefits until we're exhausted and they're annoyed. What matters is how they actually experience it. We should stop telling them how great the Bitcoin economy is going to be and start showing them. Less theory, more practice. Think of remote work. In the 1970s, big companies like IBM were merely toying with the idea, experimenting with a few workers at a time. Then technology happened. Broadband and Wi-Fi, corporate VPNs, cloud storage, cheap and powerful computers for pockets and desks. And don't forget all the software. Zoom, Teams, Slack, Meet, SharePoint, etc. But even just a decade ago, remote work was something many had heard of, but few had tried. It was growing at just a few percent per year. Enter COVID. Rates doubled, then tripled. Now 67% of us techies work mostly or entirely from home. Yes, COVID was a shock, but pandemics are nothing new. The last one revolutionized the geography of work because of the tech. The technology had become really useful, and the pandemic just gave us the occasion to realize it. Would the revolution in remote work have happened eventually without the pandemic? Almost certainly, if not as fast. Would it have happened eventually without the technology? The question doesn't even make sense, because the technology defines how we even think about, quote, remote work. Useful technology changes behavior, habits, and society, sometimes radically. We Bitcoiners need to learn, internalize, and remember this lesson. The orange pills have stopped working, at least at our current scale. Experiences are what change people's minds, and we build those experiences with technology, not conferences. As soon as we start delivering experiences that surpass anything fiat can do, people will adopt Bitcoin automatically. Until we start delivering such services, no amount of books and blogs will change their minds or habits. Where to start? So if the key is to improve people's lives, whose lives are we talking about? There's a big difference between a corner store in Hyderabad and outdoorsy Canadians. Different interests, different needs. Think about the revolutionary technologies of recent decades. The television, the PC, the internet, the smartphone, Facebook, AI. They all took root in the same demographic. People with disposable income in developed countries. Facebook took this approach to the extreme by first opening only to students attending elite Western universities. And now it's your aunt's favorite technology. Another lesson. So the way forward is to leverage Bitcoin's strengths as a borderless, open, censorship-resistant, and most importantly, peer-to-peer currency in order to improve the lives of affluent people with money to spend. Give them better ways to transact directly with each other. In practice, this will often mean adding Bitcoin to apps they use anyway. It might also mean disintermediating services they're already using, like connecting gig drivers to passengers directly without Uber taking its cut, like connecting artists directly to fans without Spotify and the record companies taking their cut, like paying Dashers directly without DoorDash taking its cut. The winning formula is to insert our tech into an existing, suboptimal user experience, just like the iPhone did with the digital camera. Utility improves the UX, and the UX drives adoption. The incumbent's margin is our opportunity. This is the essence of disruption. Let me also clarify that better gadgets for affluent Westerners are not more important than giving people in developing countries access to modern financial services and shelter from their government's corruption. That's vital, too. It's just that affluent Westerners are a more effective way to move the market and propagate the technology. They're the gateway drug, the beachhead to mainstream adoption. But yes, changing the whole world and improving the lives of everyone in it with Bitcoin remains the ultimate goal. Utility is greater than education. Education is important for people who need the inside baseball level information. Entrepreneurs, engineers, investors, etc. It's usually easier to improve a thing if you understand how it works than through random trial and error. To just use a thing, though, all you need to know is how, not why. Dozens of animal species use tools to make their lives better. A few of them might have a vague idea of the tool's operating principles. Thick stick equals strong and rigid. Thin stick equals light and flexible. And that's enough. All of us use countless technologies already without understanding them, simply because we like the experience. We don't really have to conduct much research about how to improve people's experiences with Bitcoin. It's easy to find which apps are most popular. Many, if not most, if not all, of them could be improved with borderless peer-to-peer payments, right? That's the whole idea, right? So let's add our borderless peer-to-peer payments to them or rebuild them with our tech. If we do it right, and Bitcoin really is better, which of course it is, then we won't have to convince people anymore. They'll just adopt it and convince each other. This episode is brought to you by Swan Bitcoin, the place to buy and set up your Bitcoin savings account, your Bitcoin retirement. If you want to do a Swan IRA, you can do instant buys of up to $10 million. You can do recurring buys and set up a long-term savings plan. That is my personal favorite. I think everybody should have a long-term plan to just buy every week, every day, every month, whatever it is, a small amount of Bitcoin over time. And you have free withdrawals. It doesn't cost you anything. They pay for the fee, and you can send it straight to your cold storage, and you can do this automatically. Honestly, any service that you can think of, you want to plug your business into it, you're a high net worth individual, and you want a white glove service, you want somebody to help you set it up, and you want somebody to ask questions to at any time that you feel uncomfortable, this is the service to go to. Go to swanbitcoin.com/guy, and right now, for the next $10,000 you buy in Bitcoin, or the first if you are setting up your account, have no fees at all. Whether you're buying your very first Bitcoin, or you're ready to get on a Bitcoin standard and learn everything there is to know, Swan Bitcoin is the place to check out. SwanBitcoin.com/guy. The link is right in the show notes. All right, so I really like this article from Roy and Breeze, everything that they've been doing over there. I think I've said this a number of times on the show probably, but I really think he's really always had his finger on the pulse of what's going on in Lightning, and then also kind of where we are in the Bitcoin space and in the adoption cycles. And I think one thing that's really interesting, like, I don't think he's perfectly right about quote-unquote orange pilling isn't working anymore, but I think he is right that we have gone over the we're curving the hump in the S curve, so to speak, to plateau out. And I think it's just because we've, you know, what's interesting about Bitcoin and what really makes it unique and grabs a lot of people's attention when we're talking about the people who make, like myself, who are just utterly fascinated with it as a concept, as a technology, is you find people going down the economics, the monetary, and also the kind of decentralization rabbit hole. And it's funny, you know, crypto is a great example of people who kind of go down the technological path without having any strong interest in the economic path, because there are so many different disciplines and kind of categories of education and thinking that Bitcoin plays such an interesting role in, like provides such an interesting perspective of, even, you know, philosophy and stuff. But the general person, like, it makes sense that there would be a saturation of that market, that not everyone is going to be fascinated by some economic idea. They're going to have their specialty, their interests, and what they're going to want is to figure out how to use Bitcoin to make whatever it is that they do better. And the beautiful thing about something like about a sound money and importantly about a monetary protocol is that it has every use case. It is for everyone and everything. It is the one thing that is literally ubiquitous across society when you're looking at it from an economic point of view. Like, everything results, everything needs trade to essentially exist. And I think he's right that we're moving into the era or kind of the stage of adoption where we need to be building the user experience for the people who don't care, simply so it is the tool that does the job, regardless of what it is their philosophical position is or what they believe politically. And I do think there is still a lot of quote-unquote political low-hanging fruit, but the big thing is that he's right that everybody... A big problem with, or maybe just a barrier to orange pilling, even the people who may have some sort of still kind of like lagging, or lagging is not the word, dormant interest in the topic or the economics or even the political elements of it, is that so many people have so many touch points with it now that have given them some sort of an impression, or they kind of have a picture in their head of what Bitcoin is, or they've associated it with something. And unfortunately, is something we've talked about a lot, is it is deeply associated with crypto, and also I think associated with people proselytizing for it, like specifically trying to get people to be interested or to buy it or to understand it. And a great example, I think, is the guy who recently, I can't even remember what university is, but gave the speech at the university graduation and was talking about inflation and the price of houses and the price of everything, and then brought up Bitcoin, and there was like the collective groans across the entire stadium of people like, oh my God, seriously? And like, I think it's a perfect example of the fact that like nobody there had not heard about it. Right, they all had some sort of an impression. They already had some sort of picture in their head. And then here's this guy that appears to just be shilling Bitcoin again in front of everybody when obviously his goal, and you know, I think he just took an entirely wrong approach. But regardless, I think you know, you could have gone into it with a just explain the problem and let them figure out the solution. And I think that's a far better way to get people interested in the idea. Not of Bitcoin itself, but of trying to understand a monetary problem and get them at least to see that there's a problem that's actually solvable, and that it's a far more effective to drop little seeds, to give little questions. And the second it appears anybody's eyes are glazing over, or anybody's like, don't let someone be tired of you explaining it to them. And the second it seems like that's the case, just back off. And obviously we're all infinitely guilty of going too far. But I think taking your time about it is the more important thing. And you're going to get that kind of collective groan if everybody thinks it's being sold to them. And I think that association with crypto, because crypto is even worse in that way, it's a great example of people... Just being tired of being sold something as a solution rather than seeing or using the solution. There's a quote that he has that I think really hits this. Because, you know, we talk about the specialization of labor and specialization of interest is essentially the same thing, is that people are only going to care about what they're going to have their interest. So this is why we need to target utility. And education only goes so far because you need people to care about that education. You need people to care about understanding that thing. And while there will be some degree of common knowledge, I think, on a long enough time span when we think about money and kind of monetary principles, I think it will largely come as a result, not a cause. Like, it won't be a driving reason for someone to adopt Bitcoin, it will simply be that the people who grow up in a Bitcoin world, it will simply be obvious that money was supposed to stop at 21 million. You know, like you get the benefit of the default and the one that survived. And then looking back on it, the idea of someone just being able to print an endless amount of money will just look retarded. Like it will just be simple insanity, which is what it is. It will look like bloodletting or, you know, drinking mercury to solve a stomach ache and then vomiting everywhere because it's toxic poison. We look back on that today and that seems crazy, but there was 100 and some odd years in which that was the chosen medicine of all of the scientific experts. But was it because, did we stop that? Because, you know, everybody just started teaching and everybody had some fascinating or degree of like fascination with medical expertise and, you know, learning about what all the medicines did to them? Or was it simply that the people who cared enough to learn about it realized that we were literally poisoning everyone? And, you know, yeah, your stomach kind of feels a little bit better after you drink poison and then vomit profusely because you just kind of empty your system, vomit and diarrhea. It's just ridiculous. It's like an enema, and it's absolute crazy when you look at it in hindsight, but then it just seemed like a practical thing. But we didn't stop doing that because it was some crazy, you know, explosion of education around the medical technology or the results or whatever it is. It just became common knowledge from the realization of the people who cared, from their shift, and then coming up with better solutions to the problem. If you can solve your stomach ache without vomiting everywhere and crapping your brains out, you just do that option instead. And what's funny is the solution to the problems, I guess, that need solutions in the traditional finance and legacy monetary systems and payment rails are so huge. Like, showing the solution or demonstrating the solution, like we kind of have so many excellent things handed to us because of how disastrous the current monetary system is. I guess probably the big drawback is just that the on-ramps and off-ramps into Bitcoin have become all of the problems of fiat on steroids. Is the level of KYC and the constant like asking you, like, what are you doing with this Bitcoin? What's your intent here? And then filling out like a stupid essay thing for like the travel rule and all of that bullshit. But in regards to the actual use, if you can plug that system into an application, and this is also one of the reasons why I really push, or I think we're minimizing the just in the whole, like, oh, it's you know, it's got a federation, it's not a legit L2, but the idea of eCash as a service, I still think is such a powerful thing because it doesn't have any of that onboarding problem of Lightning, and it doesn't have the on-chain footprint, but it does behave and operate in during use exactly like Bitcoin, and it operates over Lightning, so it's easy to create that crosstalk between all of those things. So where a service or an application can basically use the Breeze SDK or, you know, the LSP model, and then potentially use eCash on top of that, start to bridge these two things together, I think it's just a really, really powerful user experience where things just work and people can get zapped. And that's also, Nostr is another perfect example of like showing people how to set something up. Like SuperSu, who does wholesale, which we talk to, and, you know, I talk about a lot on the show because I've been using the crap out of it, and that and the Pear Stack for everything that I possibly can. But he got on Nostr just because we were all talking about it in the wholesale group. And we convinced him to, and he's like, all right, yeah, I'll finally check this thing out. And he got on, and he specifically posted back in wholesale after, or in the Keek group, after, you know, a few hours and posting his first thing, and I was sharing it out. He got like a couple of zaps, you know, like four or five zaps or something. And I don't remember exactly what service he was even using, but he came back and he actually posted. It's like, okay, this is kind of cool. It's kind of neat to just, you know, show somebody your project, get people excited about it, and then just kind of get a few sats. And I think it's, we really discount the power of those direct interactions and that direct payment to the person. And the number of things that we can build to get around all of the limitations of the legacy system and Web 2.0 and these kind of like platform, like we've moved to this area of the enshittification of the internet where everything that was like a huge benefit before, like Airbnb, Uber, and like these, and DoorDash and all of this stuff, it used to be a huge cost savings. It used to be a huge, like, get rid of all of the headache and simplify a lot of these things. But since they have become massive platforms, they've squeezed their margins for everything they can get out of the user. And where Uber used to be cheaper and would pay the driver more, it's now actually more expensive a lot of times. You can actually just call up a cab and schedule a cab and do it for the same or less than you could with Uber. And Uber's taking a much bigger margin because they have now cornered the market. And what's happening also is they're kind of forcing as you like move this into subscriptions and everybody's getting like Uber Eats or Uber Plus or whatever the stupid is, or DoorDash Plus, and they're squeezing everybody for these additional margins. What they're then doing is charging the normal price and charging a premium to the people who aren't doing the subscription. So if you start comparing the prices, you realize that this is actually just, it's just forcing people into a permanent subscription model and where you don't own anything. And the same thing's happening with streaming as they've become the dominant means of consuming media. Suddenly, not only have the prices continued to go up, and now we have like different tiers and stuff, but now we're paying for the streaming content, paying for the streaming platform, and watching ads. We're literally back to cable TV, except even worse, the benefit of, you know, having the full catalog and having on demand for in a virtual or in a digital environment is actually being taken away because they take things of their catalog out. They don't even leave things up there constantly because they're trying to cycle through to get as much as they can out of licensing because they'll resell it to other platforms. So you're having to constantly bounce back and forth between platforms and subscriptions. And even when you do that, they're making you go through 30 steps just to cancel and, you know, fill out a survey. Like, it's so hard to get rid of these subscriptions. We're getting nickel and dimed to the tune of $800 or $1,000 a month. And it's because of these platforms, after they take in their, after they aggressively grow for, you know, the first 5 or 7 years to try to corner a market, then they squeeze for everything that they possibly can. Another good example is Amazon Prime. Like, you used to be able to get, or the whole idea of Amazon Prime was to get free shipping and, you know, free next day or whatever it was. And now if you'll notice, the default will literally not pick the next day. They'll actually go further out and they'll use they'll act like it's the most economical, but like the whole point of Prime is to get the free 1 day or two day, whatever the hell it was. And if you look at the prices, you'll notice that they're just charging it in the price of the item itself. And the same thing happens on Uber Eats and DoorDash, is you can, first they'll charge, like, you know, the delivery fee and this just random quote unquote fee, which is supposed to be their cut. But then they're also taking a cut in the actual price of the food. So you'll get something that, like, let's say you're getting something at Starbucks or whatever, and it's $4.25 at Starbucks. You go to the Uber app and it's literally like $6.10. Like, they're charging a gap, then trying to make it look like the fee that they're charging on top of that is their cut, and then charging a subscription to get rid of quote unquote their cut, when they're still just charging you higher for the food itself. And none of that is going to the driver, and they're taking a cut of what the driver gets. They're squeezing us at every possible corner. And as they, as the platforms become these like dominant, the network effect, it becomes so unbelievably difficult to actually compete with. This is what happens. And this is where we need to tackle. This is where we need to attack those problems to separate that, to get directly from user to user. Because a great example is, especially with like social media, Nostr, I think, is such a perfect example of seeing that happen in practice, because there's just no middleman. You're going direct from peer to peer. That payment goes exactly to them. I spend, you know, 2 sats, 9 sats, I think, total, or on big payments sometimes to get zaps to people. If I'm, you know, sending like 100 sats or 1,000 sats, and that's just because I was using an LSP with Phoenix, and Phoenix charges a set rate for sats. I think it's like 0.1% or something like that. So if I'm like zapping like 1,000 sats, did I say 100? I think it's 100. A thousand sats, I'll pay like a 9 sat fee. But keep in mind, that's not a platform margin. That's just for the liquidity in their LSP. And you know, I think the Bitfinex node like charges like nothing, literally. Like, I know a bunch of people who send 21 sats. They send 1 sat and they pay a 1 sat fee. Like, being able to do that and being able to actually receive those payments with no barrier and no, you know, whole set of fees, you know, asking for a tip, getting a subscription. Like, we can actually rebuild these models with payments built in with none of this. And we can go back to being what Uber was to the cabs, to the cab system. We can be that to Uber. We just have to build those experiences. And this is also another reason why, if you guys haven't heard, I think this is big news that is not appreciated, or at least I didn't feel like it got the attention it deserved, was Arc Labs has just announced, they're officially launched, so to speak. And this is a Burak's project that we had him on the show probably this time last year. It's been a while now. Of Arc is the design of the L2 setup or model that is, you know, quote unquote Lightning compatible. I mean, basically anything on any L2 system or eCash can easily just bridge over Lightning. But it uses a Arc provider, except that it is unilateral exit for every single user. And also blind signatures. So it has a lot of the benefits, the privacy benefits of eCash, which is really, really cool. And one of the big things, one of the big drawbacks with the way Arc was originally designed was the enormous amount of liquidity needed, because there is no onboarding. So, you know, where something like Lightning, you know, if I receive my first sovereign payment, like I actually have the channel and it is in my channel and those sats are pushed to me. If I receive my first payment, we have to open a channel, right? And obviously, depending on the fees and what's going on the network, that can be a very expensive proposition. Like right now it's like $4, but a couple of days ago there was a OKX exchange thing that just exploded the consolidation transactions, and it was literally like $50 or $60 fees. It was crazy because I was choosing to open up a channel on that day and I was like, nope, we're gonna wait. But Arc is a great example of being able to do that. They put the liquidity into the quote-unquote Arc address, and then they can push it to a user and update the balance, not in the Arc itself, but they can update the balance for the user, and the user will still have unilateral exit. So they can essentially receive 10 sats or 100 sats or 1,000 sats up front without actually paying any fee. So they don't get that. It's kind of the benefit of eCash, a lot of the benefits of eCash and Lightning, with literally neither of the drawbacks from the context of the having to pay for upfront liquidity, not having that liquidity restraint on the side of the user, and then also getting the benefits of eCash and direct, instant, low-cost onboarding. But you still have the ability to unilaterally exit. The user does have the keys, and they do have all of the information necessary to publish that on-chain if they want to. So as soon as it becomes 50,000 sats or 100,000 sats or 1,000,000 sats, something that's worth making a UTXO out of, and, you know, owning sovereignly or putting in your cold storage, they can do that without the ARC's permission. They can just publish it to the chain, and as long as they have the latest transaction in the string, or so to speak, they can do that unilaterally. And that's a really, really awesome system. But the old system, or the original way it was designed, it required way more liquidity on the ARC side. And apparently they discovered some new kind of clever idea after working with other developers. I think Matt Corallo was noted as the one who came up with the way to do this. And I haven't really dug into it, so I don't have specifics yet. But that they're able to reuse old liquidity and update it. So essentially the liquidity constraints or requirements on the ARC provider itself have dropped considerably. They're still much larger than they are with another system because of the design, but it's dropped considerably from its original design, which is really cool to see it, you know, slowly become more efficient over time as they kind of flesh out the complexity and the different dynamics of how that thing works. I mean, that will be something we will be covering again as this, you know, gets out of alpha or beta. I can't remember exactly what it is, but it's available on testnet, I believe, to use. I believe I will have the link in the show notes. I haven't gone back to that, but basically there are a lot of things happening that I think we can utilize. And it's exciting to see a couple of those things. State chains and ARC are coming out soon, and both have blind signature schemes, which is just so cool to see a bunch of eCash adjacent sort of systems start to pop up, and where they're provided by a service. So there's a still a limitation in the quote unquote centralization of the service itself, because there is a explicit service provider, very much like Lightning service provider, ARC service provider, and then I guess a state chain operator. I'm not sure what they call it exactly. But it'll be really exciting to see, because the powerful thing is still that the ability to exit as any user. And when you start combining these things and you have the global liquidity of the Lightning Network to tap into and to basically bridge payments across every one of these, whether it be a Fediment and an eCash token, or whether it be an ARC, or whether it be just a generic Lightning payment for somebody who already has channels or state chains, you name it, as these things start to work together, it's going to be really, really crazy, all of the different things that we can do. And with Breeze SDK, it'll be interesting with Breeze SDK, because I'm curious, or I'm inclined to think that will be a great business-to-business model, where, like, let's say I create an Uber alternative, right? And it's built on Noster, so you have reviews and like trust ratings and stuff, and you're trying to find drivers, and you're using the app, but I'm not a middleman. What I'm doing instead is trying to facilitate payments as an ARC service provider, and I'm charging just a small fee for my liquidity. I'm charging a small fee for basically enabling the completely the simple, instant, no fee onboarding, and providing that liquidity. And so I use that as like, that's the service I'm providing, as opposed to anything to do with drivers, you know, anything to do with the, I'm not like a actual, I'm not a middleman between the customer and the service provider, between the deliverer and the user. I am simply a, in this example, I am simply a one of basically an endless number of market options to make and receive instant payments. And that, I think, is the big thing, is separating the network from the money. Separating the, like, that's really the big key, right? Is that the reason everybody has to be explicitly connected to Uber is because there's no protocol for identity. There's no protocol to authenticate and connect directly with the driver or the other user. And in fact, now they go out of their way to make sure, and it's part of their policy, like the drivers will get kicked off if they give their phone number to the user, to the rider, which is ridiculous. But I would love to just be able to reuse a driver. Like, I've got somebody that I like who's in my area. I would love to be able to just directly contact them. And I don't even understand why they wouldn't make that use, like, viable in the app and then try to squeeze them for less of a margin to just simplify that relationship. And they'd probably be more likely to catch stuff, because what they're doing is they're creating so much barrier and additional cost that people are trying to find a way out. They're basically creating the friction necessary to give a market to what we would want to build. But I guess I thank them for that, because we want to build something without the Uber itself, without the platform. But so the difficult thing is the payment without it. How do you get those direct payments? How do you get that trust-minimized relationship and the solve the fraud problem? Because nobody wants to be their own merchant processor. Nobody wants to deal with, you know, 10%, 15% drawbacks or stolen credit cards or any of that garbage, or KYC, God forbid, like a whole bunch of random people having just an enormous amount of KYC information for a bunch of different people and have the ability to charge their card unilaterally. It's a huge trust issue. Like, the entire traditional financial system is a whitelist only. It's a permissioned-based system. It just doesn't scale to just everybody generically using it, user to user, peer to peer. Neither from simply a implementation standpoint, but not from a trust standpoint either, because it's a pull system. You're literally giving them all the information necessary to pull whatever they want for their account. Like, think about that. You're the person who you were doing business with has all of the information, this exact same information that a criminal or an identity thief pays for on the dark web to take your identity and then charge your card and just do whatever they want. Like, when you use your card with any other business or service, or if you're paying directly to one other user, that's why there's a platform in between every single time. There has to be. Because you cannot do that in a trustless manner. You cannot do that in just an open market. Because people just wouldn't go to, instead of going to the dark web to get your information, they would just offer their services to ride your, to give you a drive to the airport. And they'd have all the information necessary. You would just voluntarily give it to them and then pay them. And then they could just take whatever they wanted out of your account. That system's really crazy. It's nuts that it has survived as long as it has. In the environment that we're in the internet and digital world. But we can fix those experiences. We can actually, with a decentralized identity, Nostr, ability to easily, in a decentralized peer-to-peer fashion, connect to each other and build our own trust networks, and share files and, you know, share histories and specifically signed histories, so that you can trust that other people that you also trust have a provable history, improvable use of the service or this provider or the driver or deliverer, whatever it is. And then we can get rid of those huge margins. We can get rid of those 20% fees. We can get rid of those 15% jacked up prices and pay what the price is, and then pay the deliverer for their service. And specifically because this is specifically only because we have a payment protocol to leverage. We have open payments to do so. We literally just have to build it. And I think we have all the pieces with the Pear Stack, with Nostr, with Lightning, now with Arc. I mean, obviously still early stage, but with these things launching, like, this is the zone. Like, this is when we utilize these things and make this happen. And I also think Hedgehog is a huge part of this, because it's such a huge improvement to the Lightning Network just in general, that it will make the bridge between all of these things just so much more efficient and have less of that kind of options contract expiration sort of risk that it has now, that leads to a lot of unnecessary and unintended closures of channels, and stuck payments and stuff. Just so many huge options if we can just, and that's one of the beautiful things about all of this, right? Is as you incrementally or like solve small problems at each stage, they compound on each other. Now, there's one more thing that I wanted to bring up, actually. I got to wrap this up. One more thing I wanted to bring up about from the article, which I thought was a fantastic perspective, because a whole bunch of people talk about this, you know, we're solving problems for the third world and we got to make it so that people who live on a dollar a day or a dollar a week or something that need to be able to use this thing. And if we can't, we've failed. And, you know, everybody who's not doing that is stupid or you know, causing problems and just sending us backwards. But if you look at every technology that has ever helped any of those people, like, imagine if Steve Jobs tried to make the iPhone and sell it to people in, you know, the developing world, in poor rural Africa first. It was never going to work. It needed 10 years of development, adoption, and explosion in the manufacturing and distribution capability and everything for a long time before suddenly we had $20 touchscreen smartphones that could actually proliferate in those markets. You have to go from top to bottom. I wanted to hit this quote. It says, "So let me also clarify that better gadgets for affluent Westerners are not more important than giving people in developing countries access to modern financial services and shelter from their government's corruption. That is vital too. It's just that affluent Westerners are a more effective way to move the market and propagate the technology. They are the gateway drug, the beachhead to mainstream adoption. But yes, changing the whole world and improving the lives of everyone in it with Bitcoin remains the ultimate goal." I thought that was a fantastic quote because I think targeting essentially the most efficient, the use case that needs the liquidity, that needs the technology, that needs the infrastructure, that needs this massive global web of everything. It needs every single piece in place when we are still building the bricks on which those pieces are going to be placed. Targeting them now, even though they are the goal, I think is a lost cause. You know, you're trying to put streaming on the internet before you have the bandwidth to the bandwidth or the platforms or the services and the software to actually pull that off. You're trying to put streaming on the internet in 1997. And the simple fact of the matter is it's a 2010 invention. We cannot get ahead of ourselves. And if we don't target, if we're not pointed at the right target at the right time, we will actually slow down our ability to get there. Because what is needed is capital and adoption. What we need is proof that this solves the people's problems who do have that exposure or disposable income and do have the ability to afford this while we still need to pay for additional infrastructure to be put in place. We need to be able to charge this to people who can pay the fees, who can actually bring in the capital and the disposable income to make this work. And when we do, that is what will lead to the exponential explosions in all of the provisions and all of the technology and all of the liquidity and start to, and we'll just basically make all of those hard line borders in the financial and payment networks of the world kind of just gray, kind of just picket fences as opposed to large stone walls. It will start spreading and cracking and causing gaps and movements and bandwidth across any and all of them. And that is exactly what will be needed to be able to provide those services virtually for free at the small scale for anybody and everybody anywhere in the world. But we can't work backwards. We can't start with the hardest use case that requires the most liquidity and the most infrastructure and is going to make nothing. It is going to basically be the biggest kind of sunk cost, and that's not really the way to put it, but basically the biggest challenge without solving all of the small challenges first to the markets that actually make sense from an economic standpoint. Because we will get there, but we have to do it from the right direction. It's exactly like it's the same philosophical problem as just making blocks massive. You have to build this out in layers. It's going to be a layered monetary system with lighter payment layers on top of it. And look at what we've already been able to build that nobody said we could build. Look at like ARK, state chains. These weren't part of the conversation in 2014 or 2015 when the block size war and everything really got screaming and started. Like everybody was acting like smart contracts couldn't happen on Bitcoin. Like we weren't going to be able to have any of these tools. And now we've got stuff like BitVM where we can literally do agnostic code. Like there's arbitrary code of any kind can be run on Bitcoin. Like we have no idea what is still there to be tapped. And there are so many things left to build. I mean, we've improved. Hedgehog is such a huge improvement on Lightning. I mean, people said Lightning is never going to work because of the liquidity problem and you can't do it offline. Like, we're solving those problems. We have major improvements that make a lot of those problems disappear. We have legit L2s without soft forks, without hard forks. Now we need to put them to work. Now we need to use, we have those communication layers. We have Nostr. We have the Parastack. We need to plug these things in. We need to put them to work and prove to people that everything is better. The grass is greener on this side of the fence because simply put, it is. We can build things that they can't. So with that, we will close this one out. I'm a little on time. Man, already, this went 53 minutes already. All right, thank you guys for listening. I hope you check out the article. There's a couple of other great articles, actually, from Breeze recently on their blog. So that link will be in the show notes, so you can check it out. We may cover some of them on the show, but I think if you're trying to keep an update on what's going on with Breeze and kind of what's going on with Lightning and application corners, the application of these things in general, I highly recommend that one. Roy and the team over there just have fantastic stuff. So check out that Medium page. Don't forget to like. Don't forget to drop some applause on Medium. Don't forget to follow on Twitter. Both me and Breeze and Roy. All of those will be available right in the show notes. Don't forget to check out our amazing sponsors, Swan Bitcoin and CoinKite and the Cold Card hardware wallet. Buy some Bitcoin. Keep it safe. You got that with Swan and you put it on your Cold Card. All right, guys, I am out. Thank you so much for listening. I will catch you on the next one. This is Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan. And until next time, everybody, take it easy, guys. Don't yet know the names of the architects who will build the next upgrade to the secret killing machine, but we'll know them by their work. Andy Greenberg, from This Machine Kills Secrets.